Thank you for listening to this Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler. Now, before we get started, I just want to take a moment to thank Footman James for sponsoring Last Blast. As you know, at The Intercooler, we only partner with like-minded organisations, with companies that we think really understand what it means to be a car enthusiast. Footman James fit into that perfectly. I know this because when talking to them before making this recording, they said to me, please don't talk about car insurance, which I think says a lot. So instead, I'm just going to give you a couple of reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. Coffee and chrome, for one thing. That's Footman James' regular car meet. It's free to attend once you're registered, and it's where hundreds, if not a thousand, car enthusiasts get together with their classics to enjoy and share their passion for cars. Footman James also publishes its indicator report. It's a thorough analysis and a detailed report into the state of classic car ownership in this country. The point is to promote and safeguard the future of classic cars in the UK. So there you go, two good reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. So thank you, Footman James. Go and visit footmanjames.co.uk. You're listening to the Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler. Hi everybody, welcome to this very special episode of the podcast. It's a Last Blast interview with Professor Gordon Murray, who really doesn't need any introduction, does he? Let's just run through it quickly though. One of the great Formula One designers. His cars have won multiple world championships, many, many races, and he's built cars for the likes of Nelson Piquet, Ayrton Senna, Alan Prost. He had an extraordinary 20-year career in F1, and then creator of the McLaren F1, one of the great performance cars, maybe the greatest ever. It's up there, isn't it? And nowadays, through Gordon Murray Automotive, he is creating more extraordinary hypercars with the likes of the T50 and the T33. I mean, his perspective is always fascinating. Hearing his story is always interesting. For those of you who don't know, perhaps you haven't listened to a Last Blast podcast before, but it's a format. It's an interview format, and we find fascinating guests from the world of cars and ask them to tell us what the six cars that have meant most to them are. And we also talk about their life and work. And at the end of the interview, they tell us which of those six cars they would choose to take their last blast in, their final drive. It's a fascinating interview, as any interview with Gordon Murray is. Maybe you are literally driving home for Christmas while listening to this, or perhaps it kills an hour and a half between Christmas and New Year, in that the sort of lost week between Christmas and New Year. This one is freely available to everybody to listen to. Enjoy it. It's our Christmas gift to all of you. Have a great Christmas, and we'll be back with more Last Blast podcasts in the new year.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special Last Blast podcast. I'm here today with Professor Gordon Murray, who has very kindly agreed to sit down with me and tell you not only all about his career, but as we do with Last Blast, the six cars that are the ones that mean the most to you, or the greatest cars. And it doesn't matter with this whether these are cars people have owned or driven or raced. They could just be cars that were on bedroom walls. So Gordon, welcome. Thank you very much for agreeing to do this.
Good to be here.
The first thing we do with this, and it's the same with everyone who comes on this podcast, is I ask you three questions. Your first car, your first crash, and your first race. So can we start? What was your first car? And by first car, that doesn't mean necessarily the first car you owned or the first car you drove. It's whatever, what you consider to be your first car.
Right, well, that's an easy one, because I grew up in South Africa, and you had to be 18 then to get a car license. At 16, you could ride a moped, a 50cc bike, and I had a little £10 worth of Maserati for 2 years. But as soon as I was approaching 18, of course, I booked my test, and I was desperate to have a car. And I lusted after a Healey Sprite.
Yeah.
But they'd only come out, and this would have been, what, 1962 or something like that. And they came out in 58, so even the second-hand ones were still 300 quid.
Yeah.
And my dad looked at me and said, if you think I'm spending £600 on an Austin Healey Sprite, you know. I think he also thought probably about the safety.
Yes.
And I ended up with a 56 Hillman Minx, which was quite a letdown. But,
yes.
But it, I mean, you know, you remember the freedom of having a motor car was fantastic. Yeah,
that's the thing, isn't it? It's freedom,
and,
isn't
and,
it?
And, you know, very soon I took the bumpers off and painted a stripe down the side and put a bigger exhaust tailpipe on, didn't change the exhaust because I couldn't afford anything.
Yeah.
And what I did do, it had a column change. So I went down to the breakers yard and bought a Sunbeam Rapier floor change, which fitted the same gearbox. Got some tin snips and cut a hole in the tunnel and bolted that on the top of the gearbox, so I had a floor change. Took the hubcaps off, the usual stuff.
Yeah.
Those are the only things I could really afford to do. So, you know, my Sprite didn't materialise, but I had so much fun in that car. And my mates, I used to be a lunatic driving it, you know, and my mates, when it rained in Durban, the diesel and stuff floated to the top. It was really slippery.
Yeah.
And whenever it rained, my mates would phone me up and say, can we go for a ride in the Hillman? You know, we'll take it out and drift it all over the place and bounce off the curbs and things. So I had a lot of fun in that car.
Yeah. But was it the first car you crashed, or was that something else?
Yes, the fun only lasted 2 months.
Ah.
And I was going out to a beach party with a friend of mine who didn't have a car, Glenn Durrant. And we were going out to a beach party in Durban North, which was quite a drive, probably 10, 12 miles away. And the north side, up the north coast, and there was a big road called Umgainy Road, and aptly named Cemetery Bend, which was quite a fun, fast bend.
Cemetery Bend.
It was called Cemetery Bend, yeah. I think because there must be, I must look on a map, I think there must be a cemetery nearby. Anyway, it's called Cemetery Bend. And I went into this just way too quick, you know. It was a little bit wet. And it was probably a 60-mile-an-hour corner maximum,
yeah.
With the Hillman sliding a bit. And I must have gone in at about 70. And I lost it. And there was a single-decker bus coming the other way. And I hit the bus absolutely head-on, but with the Minx sideways. And the car folded in half and went over the top of the bus and still had enough energy to go across the other side of the road and demolish a brick column in front of a shop, and the roof was down below the back of the seat, where the tent
behind you,
behind the seat.
So it had like penknifed in on itself.
Got halfway out of the windscreen, so I'd missed it when the roof collapsed, and I was stuck in the car. So the fire brigade had to come, and chop us out. And Glenn, I looked across at Glenn, and I had gone, my arm had gone through the steering wheel and I'd gone halfway through the windscreen, so I was in a bit of a mess. Cracked my skull and did ribs and face was a mess and stuff, and my hand was a mess. I looked across at Glenn, because I was still conscious, and all I could see was his whole face was covered in blood, but all it was is he'd lost an eyelid. He didn't have any other injuries. I think it was the glass or something.
Right.
So they cut us out, and they took us in the ambulance. Of course, we were in shock.
Yeah.
And took us in the ambulance. And I heard one of the guys say to the other, there was two guys on the back of the ambulance, and one guy said, that chap's all right, but I think this one might be a goner.
And I, that one being you?
Yeah, and that galvanised me, actually. I thought, I'm not dying in the ambulance. You know? So anyway, they went to hospital and patched me up and everything, and of course the car was written off.
Yeah.
And when I got fit again, my dad bought me another Hillman Minx. But if I'd been in the Sprite, I wouldn't be here. I mean, really, that accident in the Sprite, well, you know, would have been all over.
Blimey. Okay. First race. I mean, because you were, am I right in saying that you originally thought that racing was going to be what you wanted to do?
Oh, from 6 years old. I didn't ever want to do anything else. I grew up in a racing family. There wasn't a month went by without us going to, you know, Speedway or hill climb.
Yeah.
They had a round the houses track in Durban, or like a poor man's Monaco, you know, along the beachfront. with ERAs and homemade specials and things.
Yeah.
And in that was like 51, 50, 51, 52. So I never wanted to be anything, but I just speed and anything on a bike, on a push bike or anything, you know. So, when I got to sort of towards racing 18 again, the only way for me, I had no money, the only way for me was to design and build my own car. And I built what was T1, you know, the IGM Ford. Yeah. And I had, from memory, at late 66, it was just finished at the end of 66, and I entered for the 67 sports car, National Sports Car Series. And I raced it in 67 and 68, but I think I did what they called a sprint somewhere, and I did a minor hill climb. But my first race, proper race, was at Roy Hesketh Circuit in the beginning of 67, Easter 67.
And can you remember that feeling of lining up for the first time?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's definitely, it's what I've been waiting for ages. But I was a very nervous starter. As soon as you got round the first couple of corners, all the nerves disappeared. But I can remember not even being able to hold the clutch in because my foot was shaking so much with the flag up.
I know the feeling.
But as soon as you got going, all that just went away, you know.
Yeah.
But it was so exciting, really, to think, you know, you're sitting in, I'm 18 years old, and you're sitting in your own car, or 19, I think I was by then, sitting in your own motor car. You know, on the start of a race. But unfortunately, that race only lasted two laps as well, because they didn't have enough sports cars. That wasn't a national sports car race, that was just a local
clubby
club race. And when they didn't have enough sports cars, they used to throw in hot saloons and everything into the same race. So we had Simca Gordini's, Renault Gordini's, Simca 1000, Simca 1100s, I think there were. We had a couple of Mini Cooper S's and things like that. And we got going on the first, I made a bit of a slow start, and a couple of Cooper S's came past me because I out-qualified them.
Yeah.
And I was behind this one, it was a friend of mine actually, one in particular. And there's a long straight at Pietermaritzburg with a kink called Henry's Knee, and then there's Quarry Curve at the bottom. And in those days, there was a bit of barbed wire fencing. There's no runoff. There was stones and trees and logs and people sitting on car bonnets watching.
Yeah.
There's just no safety at all. And on the second lap, I tucked in behind him for the first lap. And then on the second lap, I thought, I've got to be quicker on the straight. And I waited till the braking point, you know, and unbeknown to me, he left his braking later because he thought I was going to pass.
Yeah.
And by the time he braked and went into the corner, I was still doing about 90 miles an hour, and it was a 40 mile an hour bend.
Yeah.
So I went straight off and knocked one of the front corners off the car, and smacked the steering wheel and bit through my tongue, and it was that spectacular that it was on the front page of the newspaper the next day. I've still got the cutting somewhere.
Somebody got a photograph of it.
Yeah, me crashing through the bush. You know.
Would you have had belts in the car then?
Well, I did put belts in the car, but they were uncomfortable on my neck, so I didn't wear them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gosh.
So I hit the steering wheel.
Yeah. And you raced in South Africa for a couple of years?
Two seasons.
Two seasons.
67 and 68.
And what made you stop and sort of seek a career?
I just thought, because by then I'd had to do, I studied engine design at college. I didn't go to university, I did a technical college. I did a five-year apprenticeship with an engineering company with a day release to go to college and two nights a week. So you did a three-year university syllabus, but over 5 years.
Yeah.
And I did thermodynamics and machine design. I just loved engines, you know.
Yeah.
So, in fact, my final year project was designing an engine.
What did you design?
It was a station, well, they told you, it had to be a 3-horsepower stationary engine,
okay.
But you had to design camshafts and valves and detail them all, you know, pages and pages. It took 8 months to do that. Anyway, so...
And when you say design, did you actually have to physically build it as well?
No.
You just had to come up with it.
Yeah. So I used a 105E Anglia as a base, but I gas flowed the cylinder head myself. I designed my own camshaft. I made my own pistons to get it up to 1100, which was Class A sports cars.
Yeah.
So I had a ball designing the engine and the car. Yeah. So after 2 years, I'd got so much into the, because of that, I got so much into the design as well as the driving. I thought, well, hold on a minute. I think I could, you know, design racing cars and cars.
Brilliant.
And I thought, well, the other 50% of my life was music. So it was either speed or music.
Yeah.
And in 69, the UK was the centre of the universe for both. You know, can you imagine, you know, Hendrix
everything.
And everything.
Yeah.
So I decided that I'd just sell everything I had. And the cheapest ticket I could find was a converted cargo boat, which was £130 to do this 7,000-mile trip. And I didn't know anybody over here. I'd been writing to Lotus, that's right, I wrote to Colin Chapman.
Yeah.
Got on a boat, sold everything I had, got on a boat, racing car and everything, and came over here.
Okay, this will be a very good time to have the first of your six choices.
Of the cars, well, that has to be the 60s Lotus Elan.
Yeah.
Because I was a total Chapman fan when I was a teenager. And I just loved everything he did, you know, racing cars and the road cars. And the Elan was just, I was never into E-types or anything like that, Aston Martins, you know. It was just, when the Elan came out, I just thought, wow, you know. The styling, the size, the concept of the, you know, the strut rear suspension.
It's clever, wasn't it?
And the backbone chassis.
Yeah.
And that little twin cam. I mean, it might just be a Monday cylinder head on a Ford block, but my goodness, that's got character, that little twin cam. I've got that twin cam now in, I think, four different cars. And in various stages of tune. And it's just a gorgeous little engine. The combination between revs and torque, and the exhaust and the induction sound, just perfect little engine.
And you have a couple of Elans yourself?
I've got two Elans and a twin cam Europa.
Yeah.
And I've got twin cam in, Lotus 23B.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I was in South Africa, when the Elan came out, I used to get the magazines, Autocar, Motor and Autosport. It wasn't Autocar, Motor, it was called something else in those days. Anyway, but they used to come by ship. So it took a month. And I can remember, as long as I live, I'll remember that I opened the magazine when the Elan was launched in 63 or 64. And I just thought, wow, you know, just one day I've got to own one of those.
Yeah.
One day.
And so, were you already obsessed with the concept of lightweighting?
Oh, absolutely.
By then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I built my car, I mean, It looks like it's not a Lotus 7 because the frame's very different. It's got bonded stress panels for a start. But I managed to get 80 kilos out of a Lotus 7.
Which is going some.
You know, already just in that car.
Yeah.
By going thinner gauge and these stress panels. And I lightened the flywheel, the engine, the gearbox, I lightened everything. So as soon as I got to England, even though I didn't have a job, and in those days, South Africa wasn't... we'd just gone to a republic.
Yeah.
So we weren't Commonwealth anymore. So you had to have either a work permit or you had to have cash. And with everything I'd sold, including the racing car, I had £1,000 cash. So what do? I spent 840 of it on a second-hand Lotus Elan. No job. which proceeded to fall to pieces.
Yeah.
I bought it from a guy called Ian Smith, who worked for the BBC in Shepherd's Bush. And I think he'd put it together himself from a kit. And it just kept, pieces just kept dropping off it, you know. The alternator fell off on the M4. The generator, fell off on the M4. The starter motor fell off. And then the block and gearbox separated on the M4 and pulled the spline out of the back of the crank.
Not great.
Bits like that. And then the chassis broke in half. But that was me jumping.
Okay.
So that's fair enough. Anyway, I just adored the car, you know. And then when I could afford it later, I sold it after a year, got my 840 back for it, but the guy had to take it away in a trailer because the chassis was broken. And then as soon as my wife and I could afford another Elan, we bought another Series 3.
Yeah.
And subsequently, I've got a Series 4, which has been modernised. So bits don't break on it.
Yeah. You know?
So that's, for me, is just, and I still, when I drive it to work, I've still got a grin on my face. You know, it's everything I like in a motor car. And even though it's flawed, with its chassis, a torsional stiffness is not very good with a backbone. However, Chapman used to, like me, Chapman used to build the cars with very soft natural frequencies, you know,
yes,
springing.
Absolutely.
I think that I worked out that had a natural frequency of under 60 or 70 cycles a minute. So that means you don't need the stiffness in the chassis because you've got such, as soon as you stiffen the springs on an Elan, you've got to put a stiffer chassis in.
Of course.
So I love the concept, I love the styling, I love the engine, and I still to this day get as much pleasure driving the cars as I did then.
Brilliant. So you arrive in England, essentially broke, wanting to get a job at Lotus, but almost by chance ending up at Brabham.
Absolutely by chance, yeah.
You turned up for somebody else's interview.
I did, 15 minutes before him.
just talk us through. So did Colin ever get back to you?
Oh, yes. I mean, I went the second day I was in the UK, I went up to Hethel. And my interview was with a chap called Brian Luff, who was head of engineering. This wasn't for the racing team, it was for the road car side.
Sure.
And I hadn't contacted him for 3 or 4 months before I came over. He said, as soon as you get to England, you know, just turn up and we'll have a chat. So I did. And he said, don't you read the newspapers? And I said, well, I only arrived yesterday. And he said, we're going through a bit of a mini recession. And all those cars out there on the airfield, those are unsold. And we just put 20 or 30 people out of work.
So they're not
hiring. Goodbye. So that was my Lotus interview.
Gosh, okay. But you got another one. Did you just walk into Brabham on the off chance?
I got told. I was on and off with Len Bailey, who was designing a Le Mans car for Ford down at Fair Oaks Aerodrome.
Yeah.
Alan Mann.
Yes.
And I think it was called a 3L or a 3L. F3L or something.
It meant to be the sort of GT40 successor.
Yes, the long aerodynamic job.
Beautiful, but not very...
No, very unstable.
Exactly.
And I'd been for my second interview, and Len was, we need somebody, but I'm not sure we can afford somebody. We need somebody. Phone me to come back again for a second interview. It was on off, you know.
Yeah.
And while I was on, he left the design office, and there was a couple of guys in there. And one of the old guys said to me, "He never make up his mind. He's been talking about taking somebody else on for months, you know." But he said, "Bradman just up the road. I think they're looking for somebody." And that was it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you went into, you walked into Brabham.
Walked into Brabham, met Tornack.
Yeah.
Ron. And Ron wasn't interested in my academic qualifications at all. But when I told him that I designed and built my own engine and car and won races, that got his imagination.
Yeah.
And he picked up a part, I think it was an engine part he had on his desk, and he said, "How would you make that?" So I went through the milling and the lathes and the four-jaw chuck and which tools you'd use. And he went, "You got the job." That was it.
And what was the job?
Job was a designer.
Yeah.
In those days, you had designers who could do calculations and stress, and you had draftsmen, basically. And they had like one draftsman, I think, from memory, and three designers, I think. So I was a designer. But I didn't go immediately on to do Formula One cars. I spent the first year doing Formula 2, Formula 3, Formula Atlantic cars.
Yeah.
A one-off special hill climb car for a guy. Stuff like that, you know.
And am I right in saying that as you came out of his office, the bloke who...
Yeah, the guy coming for the interview turned up. And the thing I regret more than anything is many years later, quite recently, I went to Jack Bradman's memorial at Silverstone in the club up there. And I was talking within a group of people, and this guy was standing patiently waiting, and he tapped me on the shoulder, you know, and he said, "You stole my job, this old boy."
It was the bloke.
Yeah, and I turned back to the crowd, you know, and I said, "Oh, fantastic." We shook hands. I said, "Great to meet you." You know, turned back to the crowd to finish the conversation. When I turned around, he'd gone. Uh-huh. And I never found him again. So it's a shame, really, because I would have loved to, you know, had a beer or something.
Yes. Well, you might be listening to this. Who knows? Yeah. And you progressed very quickly through. So when did you join Brabham?
I joined in June 1970. So yeah. Jack was still driving.
Yes.
That was Jack's last year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then around the end of that year, Bernie appeared on the scene. And unbeknown to us, because there was zero communication, unbeknown to us, he had bought Jack's 50% of the business. And then he was working with, Bernie was really only interested in Formula One, not so much the production cars, because we made, those days, up to 60 production cars a year. You know, Formula 2, Formula 3, yeah. Formula Atlantics and things.
40. And was that still at the stage where you could, for that sort of car, you could kind of make one basic car and then just put different engines in it depending on which set of brakes?
Not really, no. Yes, for Formula Atlantic 2 and 3.
Yeah.
They were very similar, the same chassis, basically.
Sure.
A bit like Lotus 18.
Exactly,
Formula Junior, Formula 3, Formula 2.
Formula One. Everything, yes.
Except Formula 1, by then everybody was on monocoques.
Yes.
So that was a bit different.
Yeah.
And we were still making space frames for the other cars. And we switched to monocoques about a year or two later, 74, okay. I think, we switched to monocoques for the other ones. And it was pretty obvious that Bernie and Ron didn't really get on.
Mm.
And during 1971, we still didn't know what had happened with Bernie's ownership. He just turned up, you know. During 71, he evidently bought out Ron's 50% and then owned Brabham 100%.
Yeah.
And then in the 71 season, without Jack there, we were running a real hodgepodge. The chief designer was Ralph Bellamy, and he'd done a car called the BT37. And we had a 33 still running and a Lobster Claw 34.
Yeah.
And it was a real, and you know, none of the cars were terribly competitive.
Yeah.
And I think we finished the championship near the bottom of the
who was driving the
leaderboard.
Then?
Graham Hill, Tim Schenken, I think, in 71.
And Graham was past his best by then.
Yeah, but the car, to be fair to Graham, the cars weren't brilliant.
Yeah.
And then 72 was very much the same thing. But in the meantime...
But had you been promoted? Were you as by
72?
No, 72?
Not yet. Not yet. So the end of 71... I was approached by Alan de Cadenet to do a Group 5 prototype for Le Mans to try the Duckhams.
Yeah.
And I was going to leave Brabham to do that. And then, I don't know whether Bernie found out, or I went to Bernie and said, look, I've shaken Alan's hand, you know, I really can't back out of that. And he said, oh, you can moonlight that. And very soon after that, he said, I'm sick and tired of being back at the back of the grid. During 72, I want you to, you're chief designer, I'm getting rid of all the other people, you're it, and I want a brand new Formula One car, and I don't want to use any parts from any of the other car on a clean sheet of paper.
And you were, I think, 26 years old.
I was then, in 71, I was 25.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so my first Grand Prix season with my car was 73, and I was 26 then. And then in 74, he promoted me to technical director to run the entire technical side of the business. So, and I was then, 26 or 27?
Yeah.
So I found myself running the technical side of a Formula One team at 27.
Did that sort of daunt you, or was it
not
just...
at all. And thinking back now, I should have been terrified.
Yeah.
But I don't remember even being worried about it. I just got stuck in and did it. You know? But in those days... I was the only person in the design office, so, you know, there's 600 drawings for a new car. I had to do the 600 drawings. I had to make sure the parts were made, the cars were assembled correctly, tested.
Yeah.
We weren't going to a wind tunnel quite then, so I didn't have wind tunnel testing. But rather stupidly, I engineered all three cars. So the number one, number two car, and the T car, where all the other teams had three engineers on the cars. Which was bad, really. Stupid, actually, thinking about it now.
Well, also, presumably, at the same time, during the course of the season, thinking about the car for the following season and so on and so on.
Yeah.
And did you get stressed out by that, or did you take that
off? Yeah, I had a total collapse.
Did you?
I was working just silly hours, you know. In fact, when I did the Duckhams, I was getting home from Brabham about 8:30, 9 o'clock, and then I was working a quick bite to eat, and we were in an unheated, my wife and I were in an unheated one-bedroom flat, which had it literally had no heating, didn't have night storage, it had nothing. So in the winter there was ice on the inside of the walls and the windows, and had a little drawing board like this and a tiny lamp. And I used to work from 9 o'clock till 3 o'clock on the Duckham's car and then be back at work at seven at Brabham.
Yeah, that's not sustainable,
so
is it?
Like 2 hours sleep.
Yeah.
And then I think it was 72. I woke up one morning, just fell over, basically. Had a total collapse.
But eventually got back on your feet. And
Yeah. Time for the next race, probably.
So when did you win a car of yours first win a race?
Well, the 42 actually led us first race in Spain, but we had a drive shaft boot leak. But then I had to wait till 74 to get a win, and that was once again we led Argentina and ran out of fuel on the last lap.
Yeah.
But when we went to South Africa, we won that, and that was quite nostalgic because the last race Brabham had won, was Kyle Army in 1970 with Jack.
Yeah.
And that was Jack's last win. And because it was South Africa, my then home country.
Yes.
It was and my folks were there.
And that was with Reutemann driving?
Reutemann, yeah.
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 Fantastic. Let's have another one of your cars.
Well, it has to. I was, funny enough, when I was thinking about that, the top six cars, I was about to write, here's a Freudian, about to write McLaren F1. But then I thought, hold on a minute, I've just done a better one than McLaren F1. So I crossed out McLaren F1 and put T50. Because T50, quite honestly, is everything the McLaren F1 delivered, but just better in every way. And it would have to be.
Better, obviously, because there's been a 30-year gap.
Absolutely.
But also better, presumably, because you could do this absolutely the way that you wanted to. You weren't part of any other corporate structure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And for another reason was I know what didn't work on the F1.
Yeah.
You know, they had a few foibles and a few things that weren't too clever, to be honest. And, of course, you can fix those by design, which is what I've done. But the car's good and the central driving position's great.
Yes.
But the engine is just mega. It's just mega. I still can't believe what Cosworth have done with that. You know, it's when I grew up, you had revs and power, or you had torque.
Yeah.
In a racing engine, or even a road engine.
Yeah. You
know? And even as late as something like a Honda S2000, you remember that?
Yeah, very well.
Lovely revs,
but top 9,000, but nothing in there.
Nothing down the bottom end. You know.
Yeah.
And this engine, okay, it helps the car's only 1,000 kilos, of course, but that's not the whole story, you know. The motor is just mind-boggling. The drivability and the low-down, the creamy torque low-down, and then this massive pickup.
So remind us of the spec. It's a 3.9-litre...
It's three, yeah.
Four, naturally aspirated.
399, yeah, three okay. or something.
Naturally aspirated V12.
Naturally aspirated V12.
And you were saying earlier, before we came on, you were saying that you had a target figure from Cosworth, and now you've got a real figure from Cosworth.
Yeah, so we targeted 650, and we got 665, I think it is, a horsepower, and of course the 12,000 revs. It actually, the hard stop's actually 12.4.
Yeah. And
it's just a magic thing. You know, once again, I'm an engine guy, and I've always said I think the heart of any sports car, and certainly a supercar, is the engine.
And that's spinning faster than any of those 1970s F1 cars you designed with DFEs?
I think we're around 10,000 in those days. Yeah, yeah. And it's also the pickup. It's just the most ridiculous throttle response. The F1, I mean, you've driven an F1.
Yeah.
It's nothing else on the planet at that time was like it. When you in neutral and you touch the throttle, it's like a motorbike, you know.
Yeah.
And this is three times quicker.
I drove an F1 only a couple of years ago, and even today, even by the standards, because everything's turbocharged these days. And so actually, in some ways, the F1 throttle response is perhaps even more remarkable now compared to all those turbocharged cars than it would have been, you know, back in the day. So yes, and it is, and when you turn it off, there's no, it just stops.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant.
So this one does that, but even more so.
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just phenomenal. I mean, you can't, there's no turbocharged engine on the planet that can even hope to, you know, keep up with an NA like that. And of course, this one's got everything in titanium, the valves, the conrods and everything. And of course, being a smaller capacity, the reciprocating parts and the rotating parts are all much lighter than the F1 as well. So it all adds up.
Yes, the F1 has more than half as much again in terms of capacity,
yeah,
but less power.
Yes.
From 50% more capacity.
Yeah. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. And then, of course, if you couple that to a car with the footprint of a Porsche Boxster,
yes,
the central driving position,
yes,
a scuttle height that's probably 4 inches lower than any other supercar, like the F1 was.
Yeah.
And it just, the whole experience is just mind-boggling. You know, I think I can't wait for the owners to get their cars next year. You know, hopefully they'll be very pleasantly surprised.
I'm sure they
will. Because a lot of them are F1 owners, of course.
Yeah.
But then there's equally, there's a lot of people that have never even driven or sat in an F1. And those people in particular are going to be, you know, bowled over, I'm sure, with the driving experience. So it has to be, T50 has to be right up there on the list.
Yeah. Know?
Okay. It's in a sentence, it is my new F1 30 years on. You know, the reason for doing it, the reasons, I beg your pardon, for doing it are exactly the same as the reason I did the F1.
And the way that you have positioned the car, insofar as the F1 was never meant to be a racing car, the F1 was meant to be a car that you could use. Mm-hmm. It sat three people, you put luggage in it, had air conditioning, everything. So the positioning is the same with the T50
exactly
as well.
The same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's definitely on the list.
Yeah, okay. So now we're back, we're now in the mid-1970s. You're an established, successful Formula One car designer. What was that life like back then? Because we kind of think of it, and we think of it as a very dangerous time for the drivers, although perhaps it was getting slightly better by then, better than it had been in the 60s, I guess. Fewer races than you have today. But obviously, you know, a fraction of the staff, a fraction of the resources.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got a picture of us when I did the BT44, so the second car.
Yeah.
I've got a picture of the entire Brabham team standing outside behind the car. And that was while we were still at Newhall by the canal before we moved to Chessington. Hmm. And it's 17 people. And that includes the accountant, the receptionist, and the secretary.
Yeah.
So 14 technical people,
yeah,
and that was we were making 40 production cars a year, and going to Formula One. We did an Indianapolis study, and we did a couple of hill climb specials during the year. 14 people, and the traveling people. I think we were 8. It was Herbie Blash, myself, Bernie, of course.
Yeah,
and
did you always go to every Grand Prix?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you were engineering the cars on site. You didn't have people to do that for you.
Absolutely.
You were there downloading the drivers.
Yeah, I was drawing all the bits.
Yeah.
I was helping sort out spares for the truck.
Yeah. So if a driver, I don't know, if it was in practice or qualifying, a driver came in, he didn't like the balance of the car, he talked to you about that.
Oh, absolutely.
And that you would be the one who would say, well, we need to do this, that, and the other.
Whereas by the time I got to McLaren, I was technical director over three engineers.
Yeah.
So I had three people on the cars.
Yes.
Of course, I'd go in and talk to the driver if there was a problem as well. And I'd do the debrief after the practice or qualifying. But it was luxury, you know, compared to what I had at Brabham.
I guess, you're most famous for Brabham, obviously, for the Nelson Piquet's championship winning cars, but also the fan car.
Yeah.
And that was a reaction to the Lotus 78 and 79?
79, yes.
Yeah.
Or 70, yeah. What was the first?
Well, the first one, the 78 had a bit of ground effect, but the 79 was the car for that season, which was really
the first ground effect
car to win a championship.
And we had a flat, it was quite simple, we had a flat 12 Alpha, which was much wider than
a Ferrari.
So you
couldn't do a ground effect car properly.
And their cylinder heads were right where you needed the diffuser to start sweeping up. And the cylinder heads would have been much narrower than everybody else, you know. Before I looked at the fan car, I looked at a twin monocoque car. So,
okay.
I moved the
like an 88.
No, completely different. So I just chopped the car off at the rear bulkhead, bolted the engine directly onto the rear bulkhead, so it was in the lowest part of the diffuser shape where the cylinder heads could stick in.
Okay.
Then I had a fuel tank monocoque with a tube through the middle and a quill shaft. And then the gearbox bolted on the back of that monocoque. And that moved the engine to the middle of the car. And I had that on the drawing board for a bit. But then I worked out it was going to be 20, 25 kilos heavier. And the Alpha engine was heavy anyway.
Yeah.
So I dumped that. And then we came up with the fan idea. Which, of course, didn't need Venturis or anything.
No.
Yeah.
No. And it did one race?
Yeah, Sweden. Yeah.
Am I right in saying that in qualifying you had to run it full of fuel to try and...
That was Bernie, yes. Bernie, we tried to say to the drivers, it's in your own interest not to go quickly. You know, we don't care if you're on the second or third row, you're going to pass everybody in the first lap anyway. But the drivers being drivers just couldn't help it, you know.
Yeah.
And they were going faster and faster. So Bernie pulled them in and he said, put them on full tanks. And they still qualified on the second row on full tanks, which meant the car was, you could work it out, it meant the car was 2.5 seconds a lap faster than everybody else.
And am I right? I had a conversation with you years ago in which you said to me you were quite glad that Bernie withdrew the car, because one of the myths about the car is that it got banned. It was never banned, was
it?
Bernie withdrew it.
Yeah.
And I think you said to me you were quite glad that it happened, because you said the one that you had on the drawing board would have pulled the driver's head off.
Yes, I already had the BT47 on the board.
Yeah.
And that had two fans and a much bigger surface area, huge surface area.
Yeah.
Probably something approaching 3 square meters.
Yeah.
Maybe even 4 square meters. And then because the fan drew 33 horsepower to drive it, and of course on the straight you don't want the car sucking down.
Yeah.
I had done fans with variable pitch, so you could feather them on the straight. And then...
And would that have been done automatic, or the driver would have to have done that?
No, it would have had to be an automatic,
yeah,
off the throttle or something. So you feathered them on the straight so they didn't take any horsepower, or very little horsepower.
Yes.
And then just before you got to the corner, a bit like drag reduction.
Yes.
So just before you got to the corner, they kicked back in again. And that car would have just been ridiculous, you know. That would have been... I don't know how many seconds a lap quicker.
Yeah.
And massive G-force.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you move on from that to the 49 and the 52 and those championship winning cars. What are your memories of that era? Because, I mean, it was still quite competitive, wasn't it? I mean, the whole, you know, Formula One at the time.
Yeah, Formula One was so different then. It was a mixture of unbelievably hard work and long hours.
Yeah.
But such fun, you know. You could... It was like a travelling circus with different families. You know, you could wander into the Ferrari garage. Forget the pit. You could wander into the garage and have a look at what they were doing and have a chat to... I used to chat to Mauro Fegheri or whoever was Ferrari, you know. And it was just a different atmosphere completely. But very hard work. I mean, the hours we used to... If you had a bad weekend, you didn't go back to the hotel from Friday to Sunday night, quite often.
Yeah, yeah. And then, can we talk a bit about the low-line car and why that...
The 55?
Yeah.
Yes.
And why that didn't work?
Yeah, well, it certainly worked in the wind tunnel. My goodness, we had the lift-over drag increase we had was... I mean, if you could increase the lift-over drag from season to season by 1.5-2%, it was pretty good. And I think we were like 10% better on that car. And I just couldn't wait to finish it and race it.
And can you explain just in layman's terms what the aerodynamic principle behind it was?
So basically, you've got bumps in a Formula One car in front of the rear wing.
Yeah.
And those bumps are a windscreen, a driver, rollover bar.
Mm.
And in the case of BMW, with a vertical four-cylinder engine and the induction box sticking out one side, a big induction box right in front of the rear wing.
Just where you don't want
it. And I've tried really hard on T50, 51, 52, to try and fare that in as best I could. But it just always stuck out there in front of the wing, you know. So we were worse off than a DFE or a flat 12 or a V12.
Yeah.
So the concept of the car was a few things. It was to lay the engine over at 15 degrees, so that rotated the airbox until it was behind the driver's head.
Where there was already a bump.
Yes.
Yeah.
But because it was so low, the driver's head was way above it.
So it was completely
so obscuring. So I laid the driver down. It's not a new idea.
Yeah.
Chapman, all the cigar-shaped cars, I call them, in the 60s, you know, the 1.5-litre Formula,
sure,
they had back angles of 35 degrees in those days. So I thought, what an opportunity. We've now not just got, because the engine was only this high, laying down, and then we had this airbox, which is just about there. And the driver's head was up here. So I designed this car with a 35 degree, I think it was, back angle. To get the driver right down. And so aerodynamically, the rear wing was totally clean. And of course, the frontal area of the car in itself was much lower too. So the drag was down.
Yeah.
Even though the wheels in those days were about 50% of the total drag. But it just was just, and of course the center of gravity went down. So everything got better. But unfortunately it didn't work because both Roscher and I had forgotten about scavenging the cylinder head. And because all the oil, but when you went round, I can't remember which way the engine was lying, when you went round corners that way,
yeah,
all the oil stayed in the sump. When you went round corners that way, it all piled up in the cylinder head.
Yeah.
And we got these oil temperatures just right off the scale, but only after, say, right-hand corners, that's right. Only after right-hand corners, the oil temperature just shot up. And the car just had no power coming out of the corners. Coming out of the other corners, it had all the power again.
Yeah.
And we didn't suss it. We just, neither I sussed it or Paul sussed it. And we struggled and struggled. In addition to that, the car was my first all-carbon monocoque. And the car had a massively long wheelbase because of the driver.
Because of the driver being so lying stretched
down.
Out. Yeah.
And I don't think the chassis was ever stiff enough.
Yeah.
But the guys didn't, to be fair, the guys didn't ever complain too much about the handling. It was all trying to sort out why the engine didn't have power and where the oil temperature was, you know.
Yeah.
And we kept on increasing the oil cooling and increasing it. And then eventually I went to Mallory Park, which has a long right-hand.
Gerard's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we did a lap and came into the pits and measured the oil in the tank.
Yeah.
And there was none there. It just
it all
sat in the cylinder head.
Yeah.
So it was a complete disaster. But then, of course, the redemption was when I went to McLaren. I just put exactly the same. I knew aerodynamically the thing was dynamite.
Yeah.
I just put exactly the same driving position as we had at Brabham.
Yeah.
I actually took the drawings with me, which now you probably get locked up for. But I actually had the 55 drawings with me.
Oh, okay. So there was a lot of the 55 in. The MP44.
It was exactly the same driving position. I had two cars in this building for my exhibition at 50 years. I had them together. If you look into them, it's identical, absolutely identical.
So you left Brabham in 86 and went to McLaren.
Yeah.
Did you just feel that you had done what you wanted to do it at Brabham, and you could see that McLaren were already a force to be reckoned with.
I was getting a little bit tired of Formula One, to be honest. I'd done 17 years at the end of 86. It was a little bit of that, but it was also the fact that Bernie was moving on. You know, Bernie could see.
Okay. Yeah.
He could see that Formula One, it was a fantastic opportunity to improve Formula One, and. And it was obviously staring him in the face, and he had the foresight to see that nobody else did. And he got more and more involved with Formula One and less with Brabham. And we lost Nelson Piquet over money. And of course, Nelson and I were like that. We'd been with us 7 years, two world championships.
Yes.
We lost the tyre contract. BMW were very disillusioned with the performance during 86. And they were pulling out. So we didn't have much left, to be honest. Sure. And then the final straw was we lost Elio De Angelis in a testing accident at Paul Ricard.
I remember.
And I just thought, you know what? I've had enough.
Yeah.
And I thought, I've always wanted to do like a supercar to beat Ferrari.
Yeah.
So I'll probably go and start a consultancy or find somebody that wants to fund a supercar and I'll do a supercar. That'll be different.
Yeah.
And then Ron was very, very persuasive.
As he's known to be.
He just lost, very clever him really, because, you know, John ran the whole thing, the design, testing, everything. And of course there was a huge vacuum when John left. So, and Ron could see that. So very clever, really. So I agreed to go to McLaren, but I said, honestly, whatever you offer me, it's 3 years and that's it, because that would be 20 years in Formula One.
Yeah.
And of course, I had the 3 years and the three world championships. So.
Yeah. Okay. So before we just talk about that, can we have another one of your Last Blast cars.
So the next one is actually a poster car. Okay. I've never owned one.
Right.
I never haven't driven one because I don't fit.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of small Italian sports cars and racing cars in my collection.
Yeah.
Abarth and things. And, you know, I love that era. The 60s for me was just, okay, it was my era in Formula One and sports car racing.
Sure. You
know. But nevertheless, that was a golden age of design for me, you know, with motor cars. Both the styling and the engineering, people were experimenting like mad, you know, with engine positions and frames and chassis and things. And for me, the Alfa 33 Stradale is probably the best little motor car ever built.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, it's a bit crude in places, and the interior in particular. And it was supposed to be, they were going to make 50 for homologation to go racing, but they never did. I think they made half a dozen or so, 12 or something in the end. But it's just everything I love in a sports car, a sports racing car.
It's so beautiful.
It's a beautiful thing. Aerodynamically, it's very efficient.
Yeah.
It's tiny.
Yeah.
It's not over-engined. It's got a gorgeous little 9,000 rev 2-litre V8 in it.
Yes.
Designed by another friend of mine, Carlo Chitti, of course. Yeah. And then the technical side of it, you know, it's got this wacky chassis, which has got two cast aluminium tubes down the side, which had the bag tanks inside them.
Really?
They were the fuel tanks. That's the whole chassis. It's two big tubes like this.
Yeah, full of fuel.
And then it had two magnesium castings, a typical Italian, typical Chitti, actually.
Yeah.
Two big horn-shaped magnesium castings picking up the rear frame and the suspension. And then at the front, it was one huge magnesium casting that went right across the width of the car, about that wide, about that long, and about that high. And it had all the steering, the pedals, I loved that. I did that on the BT52. I had a mag casting on the front of that. That housed everything, all the suspension, the steering, everything. Similar thing. So I loved it technically. I loved it physically. It was a successful little car in itself.
Yeah.
Beautiful little engine, you know. And it's almost worth buying one just to look at, you know, even if you can't fit in it.
Yeah.
You know, you and I would never
fit in it. Do you know what? It's one of the very, very... Lotus 18 is another cars that I've had to give up on.
Yeah.
Because the opportunity to drive them has been there.
Yeah.
I got into the 18 and they had to dismantle the car to get me out. Couldn't drive it. My feet went past the pedals. And the same with the 33. I just...
Yeah.
I couldn't even get in that.
No, I couldn't.
Absolutely no chance. Either, no. Yeah.
Somebody at the Quail had one and she saw me admiring it, you know, and I said... She said, have you ever driven one? I said, I haven't driven Saturn one. She said, have a go, you know, and I couldn't get it. But that was my poster.
Yeah.
You know, that was my 60s poster
Beautiful.
Car.
Yeah.
The 206 Dino SP sports racing car comes a close second.
Yes.
But I just love those 60s motor cars.
Yeah.
The P Ferraris, you know, the P3s.
Well, there was quite a lot of that in the T33, in your T33, isn't
absolutely.
There?
And that's, I'm unashamedly, that's what 33 is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all those motor cars just brought up to speed sort of thing.
Beautiful. Okay, so you arrive at McLaren, which I'm guessing is culturally quite different to to Brabham
very.
Under Ron. What was your actual role there? Were you the technical director with designers working for you?
Absolutely.
Which would have been completely different worked out.
I drew a few bits myself.
Yeah.
It's the first time in my life I've had people, apart from David North and one other guy, Paul, at Brabham, who started towards the end of the years at Brabham, who did drawings. It's the first time in my life I've had people to draw bits for me.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. So I could organise the test team, I could organise the race engineering over, as I said earlier, I had one person on each of the three cars under me, you know, an engineer, a race engineer on the three cars. So basically I was in charge of all the design, all the testing, all the racing, anything technical.
Yeah.
Basically. And I said to Ron when I was coming there, if I'll come, but I want the same freedom I had at Brabham.
Yeah.
Over the design of the cars, over the running of the cars, the testing, the direction we go, you know, everything. Otherwise, I'm not interested. And he agreed. Yeah. And like Bernie, he let me get on with it.
Yeah.
Never really interfered at all.
So you have. So your memories of your time at McLaren on the Formula One team are happy memories.
They are. It wasn't the same. It never gelled because there was a small group of people who were under Barnard that thought they were going to be running the business. So when I arrived, to put their noses out of joint. Sure. And so I never had the gel I had. I mean, Brabham was like a family. Mm. Everybody in the team, you know. It was just like a family. And I never had that feeling at McLaren. But on the other hand, I just got on with it and we had success, you know. I got on, that's not true, actually. I got on really well. Oh, I brought David North back into the fold because they had a terrible gearbox designer. Left just after I arrived. And I brought David North back in, and I got on really well with Neil Oakley. Oakley was their best designer by far, you know. So much so that I entrusted the future of the NA engines back with Neil again. So we did a sort of one-off turbo for 88, and then all the NA cars, Neil was lead on those.
Yeah, yeah. And just very briefly, just talk to me a bit about Linate Airport after Monza.
I know it's sort of gone into folklore, automotive folklore.
But is it true?
But it's absolutely
true. The flight was delayed?
Absolutely true, yeah, because I was just about halfway through my three-year period, and I'd already been quietly talking to myself about, it's all very, you know, great bravado to say I'm only doing 3 years, but after Formula One for 20 years, what do you do? That's exciting.
And had Ron or anyone even floated the idea of maybe doing a road car?
Yeah, Mansell Ogier.
Mansell had, yeah.
Yeah, because he wanted to do it with Williams.
Right.
Actually.
Yeah.
And so I was already thinking, my God, you know, what am I going to do? I'm not staying in Formula One, but what am I going to do? And what a high to go out on three world championships. I mean, that's the way to finish, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and Crichton was also talking about
Crichton Brown.
Yeah, Crichton Brown. So yeah. Crichton Brown was also saying to me, "What are you going to do afterwards? Maybe, you know, have you thought about doing a sports car or a road car?" And I said, "Well, actually, after Brabham, I was thinking about doing that anyway." So we'd had a bit of a conversation, but that wasn't with the group. That was just Crichton and myself quietly talking.
Yeah.
But at Linate, we got stuck there, and Mansell piped up with the idea. Crichton and I, of course, latched onto it. Ron liked the idea, and that's honestly absolutely how it happened. So by the time we got back from Italy, we were going to have a car company.
But the idea of doing a central driving position.
Oh no!
That's ages old, isn't it?
We didn't even discuss.
You'd have that idea in the 60s.
Yes.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. We didn't even have that conversation. It was just let's start a car company.
Right.
Not we're going to do supercars or let's start a car company.
Sure.
And spread the brand, use the brand, power of the brand into something bigger. And Ron also had the idea, and he was right. He said we're starting to fall behind on electronics, so let's also start an electronics business, which we did. That was Ron's idea.
Yeah.
100%. So that was absolutely how it happened. Yeah.
And when did the project that became the F1, when did that actually sort of formally kick off? Because presumably that would have required 89.
I slowed down on going to races after halfway through the season in 89. I only went to like every second one because I was looking for a building and looking for how big the team had to be. And I wrote that winter, they're all in the Driving Ambition book. I hand-wrote all the notes, and I presented those to the other directors. I said, that's what we're going to do. We're going to start at the very, very, very top, so nobody can better us, and then we can go anywhere we like from there. You can never. If you start doing a Lotus Elise, you can't do a supercar.
Yes.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. You know?
But if you start with the best car you can possibly do, you can always go higher volume or different or whatever. So, the F1, the concept and everything was just me writing to myself initially.
But the idea of doing, because what has obviously always been, to me, so fascinating about the F1 is that it was never trying to be, in statistical terms, you know, the fastest in a straight line, and it wasn't meant to be an extreme, F40 type car, however good an F40 clearly is. And was that just you, just wanting to do the best car that you could, but at the same time keep it usable and...
It was more than keeping it usable. My goal absolutely was the best driving experience. And as a designer, you know, especially if you're doing the styling, the aerodynamics, the packaging, as a designer, if you focus on top speed or a lap time, you'll compromise so much about the driving experience.
But even so, it didn't have to have three seats. It didn't have to have luggage space to hit those targets. You made it not only the best driving experience, but in a completely usable form, which is obviously was so remarkable
about
it.
Part of the driving experience is encourage people to use it.
Yeah.
So you get in a car, it's got pedal offsets or bad visibility. You think twice about getting back into it. I wanted a car, when you got out of it, you just wanted to get straight back in and do some more driving, you know. And it just happened to go quick. You know, I only wanted a 4-litre engine to start with. And it was Roscher that said, well, you know.
That's BMW, Roscher.
I didn't know. Yeah. Yes, Paul Roscher. I didn't know he had the first M3 engine in mind, the straight six. And, of course, he was thinking about two of those.
Yes. But people have said that engine is two M3 engines or related.
Well, the M3 came after that, I think, didn't it?
92, whatever. But the F1 engine is a bespoke engine.
Oh, it's totally bespoke. Yeah. It doesn't use anything. I did say to Paul, if there's a few bits like, I don't know, you know, cam followers or something that people can't see, you can use production parts. But in the end, he said there was nothing suitable and nothing light enough, so... He did everything new.
And there's also this story about the car that it was a car that was designed without budgetary concern, that you had a completely open checkbook.
I wish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't
the budget,
like that.
The budget for setting up the facility, because it was an empty building, didn't even have a tile floor. The budget for moving into the building, kitting it out with furniture, the workshop, designing the car to the first running prototype was £8 million.
Wow.
And we did it for 8.5.
Yeah. Yeah, and even back then, that wasn't a lot of money.
Yeah. But there was no constraint on the price, which was the key to doing the best car on the planet then.
Yeah. And I guess if there was a shame with it, it was born into a very different world to the one in which it had been conceived.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, the global economy and...
Yeah, it was the really worst... possible time to launch a supercar. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So was the plan originally that you were going to do, what was it, 350 cars?
No.
250? No,
that's something that's been in print incorrectly so many times.
Yeah.
What happened was we asked for a 50 grand deposit. Even before that, we went out to everybody we knew and went, we're doing a supercar, you know, put your name down.
Yeah.
And hundreds of people put their name down.
Yeah.
And then we went out and said, it's looking like the price is going to be north of £500,000.
Yeah.
And we'd like 50 grand deposit. And 95% of them dissolved into
ran away.
Yes. But then the ones that stayed, and they said, okay, you're asking us to put 50 grand down, which was a lot of money in those days. Mm. You know, now it's quite common to have a big deposit on a supercar. They said, how many are you going to make? And we said, well, we'll make as many as we can. We have no idea how many people in the world can afford $1 million car. You know.
But did you not have a business plan that was based on a sort of break-even production number?
The break-even, I think, was about 120 cars or something like that, just over 100 cars. And we thought, great, so if we can sell 150, we're doing fine, you know. And these people said, to a person, they said, that's not really good enough, you know. If it's going to be that much money in that deposit, we want it in the contract that you won't make more than X. And we came up, it was 300, actually.
Yeah.
So we all sat round, the director sat round and said, well, we don't know how many cars we can sell, but the break-evens... let's say 110, I can't remember, that's something like that. So, you know, if we make 300, that would be a fantastic, successful deal. So let's see if they're happy with 300. We went back and they went, yeah, fine. So that's in the contract. But there was never an intention. We would have loved to have made 300. But
there was never a realistic expectation that you would.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, okay. Let's have another one of your cars.
Right. Another one of them is a car that I haven't owned, but I would love to own, but I'd absolutely adored the car when it came out. Racing car, and that was a Lotus 25. It's still, I quite often get asked what's your best racing car in history. And it's always the Lotus 25.
Could you fit in one?
No. I've got a Lotus 31 Formula 3 car and I can't even get one leg in it. It's just, once again, Chapman, you see. First of all, I loved, as I said earlier, I loved that 1.5 litre formula, you know, where Ferrari did a 12-cylinder, 1.5 litre,
yeah.
Beautiful little thing.
Yeah.
And even the little Coventry Climax V8s, you know, the wonderful little cars, only 180 horsepower in those days. But, and they all had this sort of cigar shape, so the BRMs were pretty, the Lola was pretty, you know, they were all pretty cars. But when the 25 came out, you know, if you look at the jump from the 24 to the 25, 24 was a conventional Chapman space frame car,
yeah.
And then the 25 with that monocoque and just the shape of it and sleek. And of course, you put my favourite racing driver of all time, Jimmy Clark, in it as well. And I saw that combination race at Kyle Army, in a non-championship race up at Kyle Army in 63 or 64.
Yeah,
and I just adored that car, down to even the detailing of it. You know, Lotus always had red seats, red
seats. And the red dash and the red wheel room and all that.
And those two thin, long, slightly megaphone pipes.
I know exactly what you mean.
High together.
It's beautiful.
There's nothing about that car I don't like.
Yeah.
There's not an angle I don't like. And of course, once again, a bit like the 33 Stradale, it's not just the looks, it was the technology with the monocoque.
But I've often wondered about this, and you're as good a person as I know to ask, why did it take so long for me? You know, Lancia were making monocoque road cars in the 1920s. You know, Jaguar D-Type is arguably a monocoque car.
Yeah.
So why did it take until then for, you know, what would it, you know, given the lightness and the stiffness?
That's a very, very good question. I just don't know. It's such a logical thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, why did it take so long to put wings on cars?
Yeah.
Both of those are such logical things. You know, I don't know. I really don't. I can't answer that.
Yeah.
It's one of those things you look back now and think.
It's one of those moments in Formula One where someone does it and everybody else thinks, until we've done it too, we're out of this game. Because it was just completely game-changing, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It was like bolting the DFV to the back of the 49, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was another one of those.
Yeah.
So that for me is, and still is, you know. I mean, I couldn't drive one, but I'd love to own a 25, you know.
It's also one of those cars that comes from an era where cars had been developed, where they were still taking, so they're the cleaner, smoother shapes, and before they started growing stuff again.
Yes, yeah.
So they are the ultimate in sort of stripped back, spare Formula One car design.
And pre-wings, of course.
Yeah, exactly. And still just, skinny tyres.
Yeah, it's just that, and Lotus's wobbly wheels, the mag wheels and stuff. You know, everything, there's not a bit of that car I don't like.
Yeah.
You know? Even though the technology, I mean, having front inboard springs with front rockers was a really bad idea, which is why I invented pull rod or rod operated rising rate suspension, because those everybody had them because they were very aerodynamic, but they're an undamped leaf spring, you know, terrible. If you think about it from an engineering point of view, it's just awful.
Yeah,
that was the only thing, you know. But in those days, I hadn't thought about pull rod suspension, so you know.
So okay, back to the F1. You really didn't design it to be a racing car?
No, honestly, I didn't.
Not at all.
And for the same reason, I didn't think about performance figures, because I actually lined the guys up and I said, please don't tell me this is going to go racing, because I'm a racing car designer, I'll compromise it. You know, this has got to be the best.
Would it have been very different if you designed it to be that car, but with an eye on the fact that somebody might want to take it a little more?
Yeah, would have had a much longer front and rear overhang.
Yeah.
Much longer.
Sure.
To get the leverage
for
a start. So it wouldn't have looked like the F1.
Yeah. And would suspension pickup points have been different and all those sorts of things?
Yes, it would have been designed to be able to be run much lower, which was a big problem when we did go racing. We couldn't run very low ride heights because of the geometry.
Yeah.
And yeah, I would have done quite a bit of other stuff, I think,
So did it become clear to you that if you didn't make a racing version of it, somebody else would?
Well, it wasn't at the time, no, because I just didn't think of it as a racing car.
Yeah.
But then, of course, we had Ray Balm, who turned up and went, if you don't do it, you know, typical dear old Ray, you know, if you don't do it, I'm going to take it to somebody, I'm going to make one myself. And then, you know, spoke to Ron and Crichton, and they thought, well, bloody hell, you know, if they do that badly, it's going to reflect badly on us, so we better get stuck in and do it.
Yeah.
And that's when I got Jeff Hazel on board, and we started looking at turning it into a... Right, but I mean, we didn't do much. We lowered it. We put... I had one day, because the Formula One team were using a wind tunnel at Teddington, and they were using it a lot. And they could spare me one day. So I had one day in the wind tunnel to do a racing kit, which was a wing on the back and a splitter out the front, a little side skirts. Moved the oil radiator, lowered it a bit, put a roll cage and a fire extinguisher, and went racing. Synchromesh gearbox.
Yeah. It's quite old school, actually, really, isn't it?
Yes.
So how did that moment, when that car won Le Mans in 95, the first car after Ferrari in 49 to win Le Mans, at, you know, from a manufacturer, win Le Mans, its very first attempt. How does that, in your head, how does that stack up against, you know, the Formula One World Championships?
That's it for me. I mean, it's firstly, winning Le Mans is much harder than winning a Formula One World Championship. Against decent competition, that is, of course. Yeah. And secondly, I mean, I've always loved sports car racing and Le Mans. And I'd only been there once before in 72 with the Duckhams, with Ducat. Yeah. And that ran very well.
Yes.
So it was unbelievably special. And it was on my birthday as well, the race, the win. So, that's it. That you know, I've often been asked, what is your sort of highlight in your racing career? And that, I mean, winning Le Mans with a GT car, as you say, first time.
Yeah.
And first, third, fourth and fifth.
Yes.
I mean, really. You know, it doesn't get much better.
The second was a prototype, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was there in all that weather. It was the most extraordinary time, wasn't it? And so you carried on. When did the SLR project? Because I want to talk to you a bit about that.
Yeah, so that was we had after the F1, the success with the F1. What I did was I decided together with the guys. That the other directors, that carrying on with BMW made an awful lot of sense.
Yeah.
So I was in the middle of designing Project 2, and we did a presentation on Project 2, and that was going to be for volumes of a few hundred a year, I think 700 or 800 from memory, and a much more sensibly priced motor car.
Mm-hmm.
And that had a part, it didn't have a carbon tub, it had sort of part carbon, part aluminium.
Central driving position?
No.
Side by side?
It was 2 plus 2.
Okay.
So it was the same layout as my favourite Ferrari, the 308 GT4.
Yes.
So it had 2 plus 2, the same way a 911 is. Two small seats, stroke luggage space.
But you could get that. And what engine would that have had?
It had the BMW straight six, the M3 engine.
Yeah.
Transverse in the back.
I was going to say, because otherwise your wheelbase would have been...
Transverse in the back, laying over. I've got all the drawings still. Laying over with the transmission tucked underneath it, so it didn't use up much of the wheelbase, which allowed us to get some rear seats in.
Yeah.
And it would have been a lovely little car. It was going to be about 1,200 kilos, 2 plus 2, you know, with that charismatic six-cylinder engine in the back, rear mid engine, of course.
Yeah.
And
with a specific McLaren-specific tune. So
So I flew over to Munich. In one of these massive hangars with the BMW board all there, and I had to present Project 2, and from a lectern, you know, to standing talking to them and present Project 2, and then I heard back about a month later. I heard back from Paul Roscher and Karl-Heinz Karlfeld, who was marketing director then. I heard back from them to say, "You've got the job." So suddenly, McLaren cars, as we were then. Looked like it had a really good future. And then, unfortunately, I was up at some sort of function with Stal and Ron up in London. And Ron took me to one side and he said, "Got some really exciting news. I've just signed a 5-year deal with Mercedes for Formula One engines." And I actually just turned around and left. And when I confronted Ron about it afterwards. He said, well, what's the problem? And I said, that's the end of the car company. You know, they hate each other. And, no, you don't understand. You're a technician, you know, you don't understand the business. Anyway, we flew over, the two of us, in the company jet to Munich. And BMW have an office on the right on the apron. You just walk 50 yards from the jet into the office.
Yeah.
And we were going over there to formalise Project 2 with Dr. Reitzler.
Yes.
So Karl Heinz was already there, and Ron was with me. Roscher was already there, and we had coffee or something, and Reitzler came in, shook our hands. You know, he's going to formally tell us we got the job. And Ron said, oh, before we start, I just have to tell you, you know, it doesn't affect the Gordon's road car company or, you know, our road car company, that it's, we just signed a 5-year deal with Mercedes-Benz. And he said, goodbye. And he walked out. And that was the end of my, so we were stuck. So I had this business with 50 odd people and no work. So I came up with all sorts
of ideas.
That
must have been a terrible time. I mean, given what you thought.
After all that,
after the F1,
after everything,
all the equity that you built up,
we'd built up, and all the brand strength and everything.
Yeah.
And
you must have been tempted just to leave yourself, weren't you?
I was really dejected, you know. Yeah. But I didn't want to let the team down.
Yeah.
You know? So we managed to find jobs for people within the group. We didn't have to make anybody redundant, but we went down to lowest critical mass, which I think was about 25 people or so. And then to try and keep it going, I came up with all sorts of ideas. One was to do a Le Mans prototype for LMP2
mm-hmm.
that you could sell, you know, the chassis, like people do now.
Absolutely.
Of course.
Yeah.
And we got that designed. We did the first 2-seater Formula One car to take people for rides. Yeah. You know, I was trying to get things to keep us alive. And then I said, right, well, if we're now lost BMW and we're wedded to Mercedes, let's approach them to do a supercar. So we designed what was called Project 5, and that was quite a nice little nice looking little thing, rear mid engine. We're using their AMG V8, 2-seater, side by side. And I did a big presentation, and Ron and Crichton and I flew over to Mercedes to see the boss.
Carbon tub on that?
And that was, no, that was a mixture of aluminium. That was like the Project 2 for BMW.
Sure.
Carbon and aluminium,
mm-hmm.
a mixture to keep the cost down. And we presented, and I heard nothing for 3 months. And then we got this message back from Mercedes saying, the good news is we want to do a supercar with you. The bad news is it's not Project 5. It's this show car that we built for the
Vision SLR.
Detroit Vision SLR for the 99 Detroit show.
Yeah.
Front engine, you know, GT car. And that's how we got the SLR program.
And what are your memories of that program? Because I can remember.
Pretty horrendous.
Yeah.
The difference was with BMW, we worked directly with M Sport. And as I recall, I think M Sport then was only about 180 people and had one boss.
Yeah.
And so the communication was Paul Roscher and me.
And you were like-minded individuals.
Full
stop. On the same song sheet.
So we made no mistakes on the F1. You know, everything turned out just how we wanted it to. On the SLR, we got plugged into the belly of the mothership.
Yes.
And we had, during the period of the program, we had 3 different project managers from Mercedes. And it was just, decision making and stuff was just, took forever, you know. And trying to meet people that, for drawings for the front axle or the steering rack, or, it was just a nightmare. And then there was also a little bit of an identity crisis, because they wanted a sports car to go up against Aston and Ferrari.
Hmm.
But the Vision SLR, the packaging, it was just done on an old SL platform. So the center of gravity was in completely the wrong place. The weight distribution was in completely the wrong place. The fuel tank was in the wrong place. I mean, everything was in the wrong place. So it was basically trying to start all over again, keep the shape, and the aerodynamics were not good. So it was trying to make a sports car out of a concept car, which is never a good idea, and trying to keep it looking the same. And eventually we did, and you have to say it was probably a success, because they made 2,500 cars.
Yeah.
And the thing, although it's not a car that I would like to drive, I'm very proud of the engineering, the way we built the carbon tubs.
Yeah.
A robot bonded them, and we had a new way of infusing the resin from the inside out, and all sorts of clever stuff for manufacturing.
Was it the first use of ceramic brakes on a road car?
I'm not sure. It was certainly an early brake by wire.
Yeah.
I'm not sure actually. If it
was. Nor am I. Doesn't matter. Okay. Let's have another one. I think we've only got two to go, haven't we?
Yes. So we've had the ones off the wall. Another one of my favourite cars of all time is the Renault Espace.
Oh.
I just love that thing.
I had 1984 three, original Espace.
1984.
Yeah.
I had three of them over the years, including a Quadra, which they didn't make many of, which
four-wheel
had four-wheel drive.
Yeah, I remember.
And
it
had a composite prop shaft.
Did it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a you know, taper whale, I think it was. Fibre winding, composite prop shaft, glass fibre prop shaft. But that thing was, I mean, you can debate, it's the funny old story, isn't it? Who was the first of this genre? Who was the first of this type of car?
Yeah.
And everybody can debate that. For me, that was the first proper MPV.
Yes.
Before that, we had in 54, we had the Fiat Multipla.
Yes.
The Dante Giacosa car.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic little three seats.
600 cc's.
And the seats tipped up, but they didn't move or anything. And it was three rows. And then the year before this, Chrysler did a caravan.
Yes.
But really, if you look at that, it had three rows of seats. It didn't have the multi-position and the seats popping out and stuff. When the Renault Espace arrived, it was brilliant for so many different reasons. As a car designer, I've always said car design, I'm not talking about styling, car design is packaging.
Mm.
The clever people, the Mini,
you
know, the first Mini, the packaging and that was just mind-boggling. You know? And when the Espace came out, I just couldn't believe it. I just thought the whole concept. To do a steel space frame and then hot dip galvanize it, you know, that it gave them 60% more torsional rigidity, just without the spot welds, you know, or adding to the spot welds, I should say, with the galvanizing like glue, and then to have these bolt-on composite panels, and have something that was 4.2 meters long, with three rows of seats.
Yeah, it's incredible.
You know, six 95th percentile adults, comfortable. And then the first row of seats swivel round, and you made a table with the middle one.
Yeah.
You know, like the VW Caravelle does now. And the seats popped out. You could have a van. I thought the whole design, and I even liked the styling because it was so futuristic and box-like in those days, you know. And it only weighed 1,300 kilos. So the handling was fantastic. You know, the vehicle dynamics for such a high box, it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So we had three of them. We had them for years and years. And I love what I call milestone cars, or the beginning of a new type of sector, if you like, in car design. You know, front wheel transverse, front wheel drive. You know, the Mini and stuff like that. And another very clever car that my wife still got, I cannot prize it out of her hands, and she's had three of those, is the Mercedes A-Class.
Yeah, we had one for 12 years.
I'm talking about the proper A-Class.
Yeah, the original A-Class.
Not the new thing.
Which the original 1997 car or whatever.
That is such a clever car. Such a clever car. The space inside it, 3.7 metres, the long wheelbase one.
Yeah.
And the space inside it is mind-boggling. You know, and she's still, I cannot get it out of her, pry it out of her hands, because there's nothing to replace it at the moment. Well, I've looked around, there's nothing.
No, you know? and they canned it because they couldn't spin, you know, these days you have to have one platform and you have to make an SUV and a saloon and stuff, and they couldn't do it with that package. They could only make that car.
Mm.
And so they could make that car and sell that car, but they couldn't make all the variants which made the program profitable.
That's right, yeah.
So they canned it.
Yeah. So the Espace, will definitely go down on my...
Lovely. Okay. Honest.
Yeah.
So why did you leave McLaren in the end? Did you just want to set up on your own?
The McLaren Automotive?
Yes.
A few reasons.
Yeah.
One thing I haven't mentioned is I'm always looking for a fresh challenge. And Formula One in the 70s and 80s gave you a fresh challenge almost every race.
Yeah.
Because the regulations were so wide open.
Of course.
You felt like you were designing a new car twice a year sort of thing, you know. And then we had engine changes, you know, from a V8 to a flat 12 to a V12.
Straight four.
Yeah. You know, so that refreshed me, if you like. And every time we changed an engine, and we changed the engine more than most other people, it was like a new job. But then, as I say, I got a bit jaundiced after, you know, 17 years and then eventually 20 years. And I was looking for a new challenge. And of course, doing the F1 was, and then going racing with the F1 was a fantastic challenge. But that sort of had run its course a bit. And I was going to leave before the SLR, but I traveled to Stuttgart every week for several months to get that job. And once again, I would have felt a bit guilty leaving Ron and the team in the lurch and not seeing the design through. So I decided to stay for the 4 years it took to the SLR. But then I was determined I wanted a brand new challenge. And in that four-year period is when I dreamt up iStream.
Yeah.
And I took it to the board, you know, the other shareholders, and I explained what it was. And I went, no, I don't think so. We're going to keep doing sports cars, you know. So,
Not because it wasn't a very McLaren thing to do.
No, it just probably sounded a bit boring, you know, making high-volume cars out of composite.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I eventually thought, right, new challenge. Let me see if I can raise some capital and develop and industrialize that process, you know. And that was 15 years ago. And I walked into the building with six people. Once again, empty building, concrete floors, keep doing it.
Yeah.
Six people.
Yeah.
And we're now 400.
Wow. Wow. And how many of those have come on since the T50 and the T33 have been?
Probably about 100.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Because although we're sort of aware of you and your presence, you know, in terms of, I mean, you did the TVR. Mm-hmm. Which we still haven't seen, mm-hmm. 5 years after it was launched.
Yeah.
But we probably best not get into that. But, you know, it's been...
I wish we would.
Oh, we can, if you like.
No, I mean, I wish they'd done it, because it's a great little motor car. Wow. I only drove it once, but I drove it around the Top Gear track.
Yeah.
And, I mean, within two laps, you didn't need a steering wheel. You know, it was balanced on the throttle.
Drifted everywhere.
And we hadn't even started developing the chassis. That's just how we set the springs and dampers and ride heights up. You know, it's a great little motor. Well,
they still say they're going to do it.
Well, we'll see.
We will see. But what has been, for people who've not, other than the TVR, not been sort of that aware of what you've been up to until the T50, until the T33, what has kept you going for all those
iStream, really, because we got so close. We did a couple of little demonstrator city cars, which were never for sale. They were to demonstrate.
The T25. 25,
27.
Yeah.
And then Yamaha approached us. And Yamaha spent years with us developing iStream. And we fully industrialized the process. We proved it could be done. We built over 60 chassis. We did all the crash tests. We did durability, corrosion. We did all the manufacturing studies for tolerances and quality control. Everything they asked us to do, we did. And they were going to do a little electric city car, T26, which still today, I think it's 8 or 9 years old. And still today, when people see a photograph of it, they go, oh, can you buy one of those? It still looks fresh and good. It's 200 kilos lighter than the smart electric car.
Wow.
And it drove so nicely. So we had that, and then they were going to do a little petrol sports car with a 1 litre three-cylinder Ford engine, and that was T40. And that was a fantastic, even I say so myself, fantastic package. It was about the size of a Lotus Elise, a little bit bigger maybe, but it had full aircon, massive luggage space in the front and the back, and all the creature comforts, you know, you could think of in a sports car, 840 kilos. And it could have sold and made really good money for under 35 grand. And we were doing those. We had a contract manufacturer set up to build them. And we got right up to pushing the button on production. And they had a top management change and decided they wouldn't do four wheels.
That was that.
Well, that car would have now been in production for 3 years and would be making a profit. And can you imagine an everyday usable Lotus Elise, 840 kilos, you know, it would have been just... Already, everybody that had seen it at work said, well, we'll have one. You know, the car park would have been full of T40s.
You know? Sure.
And then we got very, very close with another major, one of the top six companies in the world. And once again, it was one person that put a stop to it. They were going to make a little city car, electric and petrol city car. And then we got and even closer with a big car company with the Ox truck.
Yes.
And all three of them, it was nothing to do with ice cream, all three of them were bosses, marketing usually, going, what's that? Oh, that's just, it's a what? It's a wooden truck? That's just noise.
So when one of these things in which you've invested so much time and creative energy and everything, and you get to the last hurdle, and then, a person comes up and just goes, no. That feel? Are you quite sanguine about that? Well, can you be philosophical, or does it even now really?
No, it really annoys me and hurts me. Yeah. It really does, because I know the product was so good.
Yeah.
You know, that little sports car, you get people now writing into us saying, oh, you're only doing supercars, but that's not our fault. You know, I wanted to do an affordable sports car.
Yeah.
But now what's changed now is we're not reliant on OEM. So one of the reasons, apart from celebrating 50 years, one of the reasons why we did GMA and started these cars is we're in control of our own destiny.
So what changed? What enabled you to become controller? Did you just decide that you'd had enough of OEM letting you down?
We'd make our own supercar.
Yeah.
And then, of course, before you know where you are, you're employing 100 people, so you can't stop at one car. And that's fine, because we make all those decisions.
Yeah.
But the other enabler, which has really kickstarted iStream again, is electric vehicles and startups. So we don't have to wait for an OEM anymore. We've got people banging the door down at the moment who have the battery technology or the powertrain technology or even the electrical architecture and the electrical components, but they have no chassis technology. And that's iStream.
And that's you.
So we have people literally knocking the door down at the moment. And we're actually working on a couple of programs for customer programs. And so we don't have, because if you think about it from the OEM's point of view, iStream is so disruptive from a technology point of view. It's nothing like stamp metal. And they have got a lot of money, of course, invested in stamp metal, but a lot of knowledge as well. So it's like trying to stop the oil tanker and turn it around, you know, with an OEM that's been building spot welded stamp metal cars for 40, 50, 60 years. Whereas now we've got these startup companies everywhere, and doing a startup electric car without the complex and expensive ICE powertrain, they're all over the place now. So people are all looking for a chassis technology.
Yeah, which you have.
Which we have.
Let's have your last car.
The last car is something I had built very recently by a company called Alphaholics down in
down in Bristol.
Bristol way.
Yeah, the Banks brothers.
Yes, Max and Andrew. And they do such good work, you know. And they do this, you've probably driven one, this GTA. GTA R do. And it takes the 101 platform or whatever it is.
So 105,
105
I think,
platform. Yeah, 105 platform. And they have all their own bits, you know, and they put a relatively modern, I think it's 80s, all aluminium, 2.1 twin cam in it.
Yeah.
And they just do great work. And I didn't know them at all. Somebody told me about Alphaholics, and I've never met Max. And a car I've always loved the look of was the Zagato Junior.
Yes.
Which actually, when it came out, it was a real Marmite car. You know, it really split opinion amongst the Alfistas, because everybody had been used to the Bertone and Pininfarina, lovely rounded sprints, GTs.
Yeah, yeah.
And suddenly this, I think Ercole Spada did the design.
Ercole Spada, yes, he did, yeah.
And suddenly you get this mad angular wedge thing with a Perspex front end with offset slots and... all sorts of
it looked amazing.
Wacky. And I fell into the camp of love. Yeah. But a lot of people hated it. You know?
Yeah.
It was exactly the same with Ferrari when they went from Pininfarina to Bertone, he came out with the
GT4.
Yeah. It split people down the middle.
Yeah.
I loved it again, and I've got one.
Yeah.
I love the shape.
Yeah.
But a lot of Ferrari people hated it and didn't buy it. Didn't help the fact that it had a Dino badge on as well, I think. But
in the early days, yeah.
They didn't like it. So I phoned Alphaholics, and Max is in California, so they give me Max's mobile number. And I phoned Max, I don't know Max at this point. And I'm thinking, I wonder if he's the hate or the love for 50%, you know, on the junior shape. So I phoned him and I said, Max, I'm really interested in one of your GTARs, but I don't want it on that chassis. I want it on a Zagato Junior.
Wow.
And there was silence. And I thought, oh, he's probably he's on the 50% that didn't like it. And then he came back and he said, I love that car. I've always wanted to do one of our, you know, GTRs. He said it's the same platform underneath, which I didn't know. And that was the beginning of the journey.
So he's done it?
2 years later, about 2 years ago, I get the car. And it's fantastic. And of course, because with Alphaholics, you can work with them on the spec.
Mm.
So we did some quite different things. I wanted it to be everyday usable, so I could run it up and into winter a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's got proper heater and aircon and electric windows and all that sort of stuff, heated seats. I took the opportunity, we worked together to change the few things I didn't like on the styling. And Max agreed, and he pointed some of them out, in fact. And, you know, for example, the door handles were a big square black and chrome Fiat item stuck straight in front of in the middle of the door panel, you know. So they've taken those out because we had to do the body shell took a year. They had to lower the 4 or 5 inches to get me in, and move the main beam back 6 inches behind me to get my leg room.
Yeah.
Would never fit in a normal one, and. So together we worked on the sort of styling, and they put these little Ferrari Dino door handles on the top. And then the fuel filler was a great big square racetrack in the side, the flank, the rear wing. So we got rid of that. We put a little aluminium fuel filler in the middle of the boot at the back. And it had about an inch wide rain gutter with a trim strip on it. Got rid of all those. And then the final thing was the rear bumper, the only bit I never liked. It had this black and chrome rubber sort of folded rear bumper. So they actually cut that off and made a brand new rear bumper, which is just painted. And I picked this sort of green Mamba, bright green.
Yeah.
And it looks fantastic, but it drives. I can't get out of the thing, you know. I've already put 2,500 miles on it, you know. And I've done a couple of track days with it.
Yeah.
But it's my sort of car. It looks great. It's a tiny footprint, but I'm ergonomically comfortable, which is unusual. All my other little Italian cars got the usual ergonomic issues, you know, for somebody like you.
Long arms, short legs, all that, yeah.
So it's, you know, spacer, smaller wheels, spacer, take the seats off the runners, bolt it to the floor.
Yeah.
Take the rubbers off the pedals. You know. whereas this, I'm ergonomically, it's perfect.
Yeah.
And the engine's gorgeous, it revs, it sounds wonderful. And it looks great too, you know, and I've done a couple of rallies in it already. And so that's definitely my
brilliant. Okay, so before we wind this up, how does Gordon Murray do an electric sports car? Because I've asked so many people how you do an electric sports car, and I haven't really heard a convincing answer. How do you, you know?
I think with the current battery technology and the current, you know, power density, which is rubbish of modern batteries, current batteries, I beg your pardon. I think the only way an electric sports car works is not to try and do a supercar, because it's a bad spiral, you know.
Yeah.
You need the power, you need a bigger motor, you need a bigger battery, and before you know where you are,
you've got a two-ton car. Yeah.
Which can't be a sports car, in my opinion. So I think if you want to do an electric sports car, you would take Yamaha's T40, and you would say I only need 150-mile range because I'm just going out for some fun.
Because it's a recreational car.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I've got my everyday electric car or petrol or whatever you're driving.
Yeah.
This is to have some fun. Mm. But I want an electric sports car. And you do something that weighs maybe 1,100 kilos. That's still light enough for the vehicle dynamics to be good.
Yeah.
And you have 150-mile range, you know, or 120-mile range to keep the battery as small as possible.
Yeah.
And
you haven't got a gearbox, you haven't got that sound. No. There's all sorts of stuff you're not going to have, and there doesn't seem to be a...
I'm not saying I would do that, but yeah. If you ask me how you would do an electric sports car, with the current battery technology, I wouldn't even attempt to do a supercar. I would do a lightweight, fun MX-5 type, or even smaller, you know.
Brilliant. Okay. We're going to wrap it up now. So now is your time to tell me what car you would take your last blast in, where you'd do it, and if anyone, who'd be with you when you did.
Okay, well, that has to be T50.
Yeah.
It's just a no-brainer. If the T50 was rubbish everywhere else but the sound of the engine...
It would still do it.
It would still do it for me. If it didn't handle, it didn't go around corners, you know, it had bad traction, but it had that engine sounding like that and revving like that, that would be it. I mean, I might be wrong, but I can't see anybody now with electric cars coming on and everything doing another little 4-litre V12. I don't think so, anyway. Yeah. And if they do, they'll have to go to Cosworth, because only Cosworth can do one that revs to 12,000. So it would have to be 50. And also, it's not just the engine. It's sitting in the middle, you know, and it definitely would be on my own.
Yeah.
And it would probably be around where my house is, up in the Highlands in Scotland.
Brilliant. Gordon Murray, thank you very much indeed for coming on the Last Blast podcast.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Brilliant.